Well, if you can see or hear, you've heard a lot about China over the last 40, 50 years, maybe even the last century or so. Good morning, everybody. This is Frank Morano on 77 WABC. You're listening to The Other Side of Midnight. Now, you might have heard how China has a lot of human rights problems. You might have heard how China manipulates their currency. You might have heard how China engages in things like intellectual property theft. You might have even heard about calls to boycott the Olympics that are going to be taking place in Beijing. One thing I'm betting you haven't heard about, or at least not a great deal until now, is what China has been doing to Hollywood. You remember the movie Independence Day? We all remember Independence Day, how we're able to beat the aliens at the end. The American president's able to act like a big hero fighter pilot. The Americans are able to do it. Well, in the second Independence Day, we weren't able to beat the aliens without the help of the Chinese. In that movie, with The Martian, with Matt Damon, the technology that rescues him. Remember, it's Chinese technology. In movie after movie, Gravity. Remember how Sandra Bullock got rescued in the movie Gravity? She was rescued by the Chinese. We can go film after film, example after example, about how China is portrayed overwhelmingly positively in Hollywood motion pictures. Do you think that's a coincidence? Do you think it's a coincidence that while there are plenty of Arab-looking bad guys in movies, there are very few Chinese bad guys in movies? Why do you think that's the case? Well, Chris Fenton is a longtime Hollywood executive, a film producer, and he's the author of this new book, which I just can't wait to read, called Feeding the Dragon. And he's analyzed some of the issues that we're talking about. Chris, good morning. Thanks for staying up late with us. I guess on the West Coast, it's not that late.
Yeah, it's not too bad out here in Los Angeles. We get a 3-hour reprieve from that. But really, really excited to be on the show. I listened to that Jesse Ventura episode you had recently, and I was like, I got to get on that thing. How do I talk to this guy, Frank?
Well, please, I am a fan of yours. You've produced a number of films that I've enjoyed very much. And what you're talking about with this book, Feeding the Dragon, I can't think of anything more pertinent. Now, but besides the handful of examples that I just gave, can you give the listeners some examples of how it looks like Hollywood is kowtowing to China in terms of the, before we get into the why, how they do it in terms of the product that folks see on the scene, on the screen?
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, the journey of Hollywood with China and sort of the interaction there really started in 1997. There were three movies that Hollywood just went and made because they go and make good stories, and sometimes they turn into bad movies, or sometimes they turn into good movies. But in the case of 1997, China didn't have any sort of market whatsoever for movies, but everybody knew eventually that dragon was going to wake up and turn into something. Well, Hollywood at the time just went and made three movies. One was Red Corner, another one was Kundun, and the other one was 7 Years in Tibet.
I liked all three of them, by the way. I thought they were all good.
Well, all three of them covered some of the things that you were talking about just earlier as you introduced this show. They didn't show China in the best light. The Chinese weren't heroes per se. There were definitely some villains. They definitely treaded on things like Tibet, for instance. They showed criminal activity in China, a lot of things that the Chinese Communist Party wasn't excited about. So they immediately made sure that the Hollywood studios that were involved with each one of those films understood that China was upset. The Chinese Communist Party said, we don't like those movies. And then Hollywood said, yeah, you know what? That's okay. We're not planning on showing them in China. And they said, no, you're not going to show them anywhere on earth. And Hollywood's like, no, that's not the way we work. We're showing them around the world. And they did. And China immediately said, all right, well, Disney, you're responsible for one of those. Your movies are not getting in for a while. And in fact, that theme park that you've been trying to open up by year 2000, 2001, we're going to put a little delay on that and not let you open it up until about 2016. Okay. So that's essentially the repercussions of going against the Chinese Communist Party's wishes. And Hollywood woke up to that really quickly in 1997.
And so just so I understand, so what China was doing was saying, we don't like these movies. So not only are we not going to show them here, we're not going to allow any business that your studio does whether it be film or theme park in the case of Disney, to take place in China for the foreseeable future.
That's exactly the case. And there's some great coverage of, for instance, Michael Eisner, who was the CEO of Disney, immediately hopping on a plane with several of his lieutenants to go over and essentially kiss the ring of the Chinese Communist Party and said, okay, we learned our lesson. It'll never happen again. They still got punished quite a bit. And as we've seen, even with more recently, in October of 2019, the Daryl Morey tweet, the GM of the Houston Rockets, who just tweeted out seven words in his support for the democracy push of the Hong Kong protesters, that immediately penalized the NBA for a whopping 17 months. In fact, they just went back on broadcast television last week for the All-Star game. So 17 months of punishment for seven words.
Wow. So going back to Hollywood for a second, because that's your experience, now that we have an idea of the history, I think a lot of listeners may listen to this and shrug their shoulders and say, oh, okay, all right. So China wants certain films. They want certain films not shown. What difference does it make to the consumer? I do remember the film The Arrival, where the solution to beating the aliens in that film was, or solving the problem with the aliens, was discovered by a communist Chinese general. But are there any other specific examples that you can think to point to that our listeners may recognize of Hollywood painting China or Chinese characters in a rosier light than they may have, say, 24 years ago?
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes it's very subtle, but in a lot of ways, and in a lot of stuff that I'm out there talking about, which I explain in the memoir that I wrote, was how the process works to essentially brand integrate China into a movie. You know, almost like, I mean, if you watch a sitcom on television or a dramatic series, you might see product placement in terms of China. You may see the product placement of backgrounds and backdrops that take place in China that sort of showcase China and all its splendor. And in fact, in the movie Looper, which was a sci-fi thriller that we were involved with, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Bruce Willis, the future in that movie took place in Shanghai, 40 years in the future. And we actually worked with the Chinese government to create the skyline that would showcase Shanghai as the greatest city on earth 40 years down the road. And in fact, what's crazy about that is, okay, well, we did product placement for China in that movie, but even more so, which is a bit nefarious, is that we actually changed the plot of the movie to China. It was originally supposed to take place in France, but we knew we would never be able to get the movie into China and monetize China unless we really brand integrated China in all its splendor in the film. So we actually relocated the movie to China. We actually had all the dialogue of the characters talk about China being the mecca of where everybody wanted to live in the future. And in fact, there's an interaction between Jeff Daniels and Joseph Gordon-Levitt where Jeff Daniels comes back into the present day and asks Joseph Gordon-Levitt in the present day, hey, where do you want to retire someday? And Joseph Gordon-Levitt says, well, I want to move to France. I want to learn French and marry a French woman. And Jeff Daniels slams down his fist and he says, you don't want to move to France. I'm from the future. You want to live in China. And it was one of the great testing moments. You test them with the National Research Group before you lock the movie just to see if there's problems that a particular audience sees. And that was the best testing moment in the film, like the shot, the money shot for promoting China in all its splendor and placating the CCP in every way possible to get the wind to our back with that movie also happened to be the best testing moment of the film. So in a way, when I look back at it, I go, God, we sort of pulled one over on people without them knowing. So now I'm out there saying, okay, well, that was a little more innocent than, say, cut to today. And you look at Senator Ted Cruz talk about the new Top Gun movie and the fact that they removed the Taiwanese and Japanese flag from Tom Cruise's jacket in it, not just for the China market, but for the worldwide market, because China does not want people recognizing Japan and Taiwan in a movie about the U.S. military.
And so the reason that China cares so much about this, and if people are just tuning in, we're talking with Chris Fenton. He's the author of the book Feeding the Dragon, is because they want China's brand to be a positive one with the rest of the world. Is that what it's all about in their view?
Yeah, remember, and by the way, any of your listeners that are on Twitter, follow me at the Dragon Feeder. I love interacting because a lot of this stuff is sort of new to people, and they don't. They're like, "Wait, how does that work?" And part of the conversation I have about this is Hollywood's just one of the fish in this big ocean that's doing it. Every business is placating the CCP in this particular way and censoring how they talk about China outside of their borders, and essentially placating the CCP in various other ways. So, in your question, you're asking, do they want to promote China in a particular way? Well, the Chinese government, their number one objective is to keep 1.4 billion people just happy enough that they don't revolt. They want they don't want another Tiananmen Square incident. So to do that, they need to showcase that they're the greatest government on earth and that China is the greatest nation on earth. And when things like, you know, what happened on January 6th, or if you have a terrible, you know, civil unrest in the United States, that stuff plays really well into them. They showcase that on the news all day long, right? But on top of it, when you have a movie that they know is going to be part of the cultural fabric of people around the world watching it, and there's an ability to showcase China in a certain way, they force Hollywood to do it. And if they don't, they shut market access down. And that's 800 million people in the middle class. Imagine that. That's like four times the middle class of the United States of America.
Wow. That is wild. Again, the book is Feeding the Dragon. We're talking with its author, Chris Fenton. All right. So has any other country in history ever done this effectively with, forgetting about Hollywood or sports, has there ever been an example of a country that had such a large economic footprint that they could essentially have their way with whole swaths of industry in foreign countries?
First of all, Hollywood does censor content for given markets, okay? That's something we live with. We've lived with for a long time. There's certain things that don't work in Japan, so you censor them, or South Korea, or in the Middle East, or whatever it is. And China's the same way. And quite frankly, and I know I'll get some crap probably on social media about this, but I'm okay with that too, because their market is specific. There's certain things that are just not in the cultural fabric. Where the problem is they're trying to censor us and proactively propagandize Hollywood outside of their borders. That's where the real issue is. And they have the leverage because of the market. Now, you could argue Saudi Arabia, right, which has terrible human rights and all kinds of things that we don't agree with, they could try to do the same thing. But Hollywood doesn't care because there's only 30 million people in Saudi Arabia, but there's really not a very large potential Western content market there ever. So Saudi Arabia could try to push that all the time on us, but we're not going to budge because it just doesn't have the financial ramifications that something that China does. And there's no other market even close to it. I mean, put it this way. In 2009, there were 5,000 movie screens. Cut to today, there are 77,000 movie screens in that market. That's how fast the market has grown. It is going to be the largest market in the world as of last year for the rest of time. There is way too financially at stake.
Now, how are you able to talk about this? You talk about the movie Looper that you were a producer of, which made some consolidations to China. You focus in the book a bit about Iron Man 3, which certainly made some concessions to China. And I'm reminded of the old adage from some old school political bosses who love to repeat the refrain that a smoke-filled room isn't so bad as long as it's your smoke that's blowing. How is it that you, who've kind of drank at the well of the China-Hollywood altar, how can you be so open and vocal about this?
Well, you know, it's first of all, it's a great question. I'm calling you from an underground bunker that I haven't left in the last year. But it's an interesting question because, honestly, for 20 years, I really didn't understand the ramifications of what we were doing. None of us really did. I mean, it wasn't like a bunch of greedy capitalists selling the soul of America. we're doing this for the past 40 years when we finally had Kissinger and Nixon on the ground there and we opened up the market or started to. It was really this belief in globalism where the more we opened the market to products and services from the United States, the more GDP growth we'd have here in America, the more jobs we'd create, and the more spreading of soft power of that aspirational quality of democracy would penetrate that market and eventually win them over into a democracy like ourselves. Now, of course, we haven't seen that happen. And then on top of it, over time, and this is something I'm very vocal about, we have been teaching them process. We have been doing tech trades with them, tech swaps. We have been doing forced joint ventures with them. They have been stealing a lot of our process and our IP in the process. So what has happened now is we have fed the beast or fed the dragon so much to placate them, to open that market, that they had now created imitators to every kind of business and industry that we have out of America. And we're starting to see our market shares decline because those imitators have become our greatest competitors. I'll give you one example. In 2012, we had roughly 80% market share of the box office there when it came to Hollywood. We cut to last year, a COVID year, it was down to 16%. The year before, which was not a COVID year, it was 32%. But one movie made a lion's share of that, which was Avengers. That made $700 million alone in China. So we are losing that market, not just in Hollywood, but we're losing it now. They're about to launch their first commercial airline, which looks awfully like an Airbus and a Boeing put together. Mm. We're losing it in the coffee chains and the fast food chains and the hotel chains and microchips, you name it, automobiles, it is happening to us, and it's happening to us in rapid speed. So I am out there being a squeaky wheel, and I am gaining momentum, and there are others joining the cause, and we're now starting to see as a nation that this is something we have to address. So I feel good about the fact I'm making progress. I'm not feeling great that I had to put my career on hold or whatever, but you know what? This is something that's super important. I have two 14-year-old kids, and I want them growing up in a strong America.
I could talk with you for an hour about this, and I hope you'll come back, but a couple of items I want to pick your brain on before we run out of time here is, what is the alternative? What are we supposed to do? Look, if you're in Hollywood, if you're in professional sports, especially along the magnitude of the NBA or a major sports franchise within the NBA, you want as many people as possible purchasing your product. China, we may not like the rules of the game, but they control, they're the gatekeeper to over a billion people. What is Hollywood? What is the NBA? What are other fields supposed to do?
Well, it's a great question. It's going to involve a little bit of sacrifice and a little bit of disruption on the short term. Okay. So if you look at the case of the NBA, and I want to use that because there's a recent example that plays into it. Daryl Morey used his freedom of speech rights that he has when he's on his own soil in Texas. Okay. He tweets out 7 words supporting the democracy rights of these Hong Kong protesters. What should have happened at that moment is Adam Silver and the rest of the NBA should have come out and said, he's an American citizen. He's one of ours. We support what he said. And quite frankly, we support the democratic rights of those protesters also as the NBA league, because we are social justice warriors or whatever it is. Okay. Now, what would have happened immediately, which already happened anyway, even though they stayed quiet, is there would have been punishment. And the punishment would have been taken off all the television screens, all the streamers, the partners all shut down, everybody runs for the hills, consumer products aren't on shelves, all that stuff. And that all happened anyway, even though they were crickets about supporting Daryl Morey. But what should have happened is they did the right thing. Then the repercussions of the retaliation by the Chinese would have happened anyway, which it did. And then the sports community should have rallied around the NBA and said, hey, we know you can take the NBA off the shelves and off the screens over there, and it doesn't disrupt the populace and make them unrestful because they can't see the NBA. They'll flip to something else. But us as the sports industry, the international sports industry, are going to stand behind the NBA and their rights to free speech together, and we are shutting you out from any of our products and services. Mm. And in that case, that is way too much for that public to handle. That's way too much stuff that comes off the air, comes off the shelves. Consumers get restless. And next thing you know, you have another Tiananmen Square that starts to bubble up. Okay. There's strength in numbers. There's solidarity. And before you say, well, that sounds impossible, you could never do that, I would point back to last summer and the violence against blacks by police, the protests, the BLM situation where the NBA took a stand and they boycotted playing in games. And guess what happened? The whole sports community got behind them around that domestic issue. We can do the same thing with an international issue. We just proved it in one case study. We can do it with another.
Well said. Finally, given all the possible, we haven't even discussed COVID and the Chinese government's role in COVID. Maybe we could do that next time you're on the program, hopefully, which will be soon. But whether you look at tariffs, whether you look at currency manipulation, whether you look at the lender-lendee relationship, whether you look at intellectual property theft, or whether you look at what China is doing to Hollywood, American sports, and so forth, do you think a new Cold War, maybe even worse, but a new Cold War with China and the United States is inevitable?
Well, look, I have 14-year-old kids. I do not. I just turned 50. I grew up with that crazy sort of USSR U.S. confrontation that was constantly going on as I was a kid. I remember seeing the day after about, you know, nuclear war hitting the U.S. from the Soviet Union. That's not something I want them growing up in. OK, I don't believe we're going to agree with China on politics, human rights or national security issues. I call them Fenton's five forces of diplomacy in my book. Those three, let's throw out the window. Cultural and commercial exchange, I believe we can agree on because there's money to be made. And there's aspirational qualities that the Western alliances have and have created that the Chinese consumer wants. So what we need to do is say, you know what? We can't decouple. There's no way. We got 40 years of entanglement that has occurred that is impossible to disentangle unless we go to war. And we do not want war with another superpower with nuclear warheads. And we don't want a cold war that just goes on forever and eventually escalates into a real war. What we must do is reset and rebalance the relationship. And there's a lot of little baby steps that can lead us to a great North Star in that. And you talk about currency manipulation and all that kind of stuff. You could start with the WTO, the World Trade Organization, which designated them as a developing nation in 2001. Well, 20 years later, they're now a developed nation. That changes the dynamic a lot on trade parameters. The SEC, Securities Exchange Commission, recognizes their companies as state-owned enterprises, which get to hide behind state secrets laws, so they don't apply the same accounting standards when they have access to our American capital markets. We got to change that. There's a lot of those little check marks that we can keep checking away to eventually get to a brand new reset in this relationship that allows us to be strategic competitors, but also allows us to monetize the heck out of that market, which we helped create, by the way.
Well, look, I cannot wait to read this book. I can't wait to talk with you on the radio again. I want to encourage everybody to get it. This is a big, big problem. And if folks are wondering why they don't make movies like they used to, I think this is a tremendous, tremendous partial answer to that question. The book is Feeding the Dragon. We've been talking with Chris Fenton. Chris, I do hope you'll come back and thank you for writing this book. It's an important conversation and one that needs to be had.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. And I really want to give a shout out to the Yankees this year. I hope they make a run.
Well, look, even though I'm a Met fan, I will look forward to seeing you the next time that you're in New York. And hopefully by that point, we'll be able to actually go to baseball games and not have to sit 100 feet apart from everybody.
Hear, hear. I'm with you.
All right. Chris Fenton, if you want to comment on any portion of my conversation with him, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight.